always, you know, somebody to say hi to, wave to, smile at, and feel like it's home.
All right. That's a great update. You guys are here. Celebrities now. Two things that I really liked in that video that you said, Chelsea, when you said, you get out of it what you put into it. If you're in a connection group, you know that's true. So if you're gonna jump in, you get out of it what you put into it. And I think the other thing was that, Danny, that you said is, did you hear that? The one downside of connection groups is we have too much fun. You can't beat that. I mean, come on. So I hope you'll take Randy's advice and explore what that opportunity might look like for you and check out connection groups. As you said, Chelsea, it does take Keystone from here to here. So helpful. Well, welcome in this morning. Go ahead and turn your Bibles to Esther chapter 9. As Randy said, we are going to close out this series that we've been in. And I don't know about you, but just in studying through it and in listening to the sermons myself and in preparing, it's been such helpful content as we've looked through the book of Esther. We're going to do that again. And so 8:30, welcome in. My name's Matt Fry, and it's great to have you here at the tail end of this. And all these sermons back through the beginning of the book are online, and we'd love for you to check those out. So Esther chapter 9 and 10. 10's only three verses. We're going to read the whole thing in a minute. I wonder, when was the last time you dropped the ball? Some of you are like, Fry, I'm the reason they came up with that phrase. Right? Like, you dropped the ball this morning coming to Keystone Church. Jolynn and I have been to, she's in the front row. She didn't know I was going to tell this story, but I am. We became a thing like in high school. Became a thing. Do they still say that? Probably not. But we started dating in high school right before she turned 16. Don't recommend it, but that's how it went down. And right as we started dating, it was her 16th birthday, sweet 16. You remember this? You know what I'm gonna say? Yeah. And I forget if it was a surprise party or not. I think it was a sweet 16 birthday party that her mom, my mother-in-law, Mimi, love you. And she planned a birthday party for Jolynn. And so I'm the new boyfriend, sweet 16. You don't wanna get this wrong, do you? I did. I forgot it was the birthday party, literally. And you're like, now things are making a lot more sense with you, Matt. But truly, I walked into the house. I will never forget that. I walked in into the kitchen and went downstairs, and there was people there I didn't know. It was one of the moments where I was like, oh, what do we got going on here? You know? It's like, what do we got going on here? Boyfriend of the year? It's her 16th birthday. You know, driving the car, and it's sweet 16. I blew it. Totally dropped the ball. So we've recovered from that. My mother-in-law hasn't brought it up for a month or so, but when was the last time you dropped the ball? It wasn't on my calendar, right? Google and Apple, you got everything synced. You've already looked at it this morning. Some of you have it connected to Claude. Your calendar wakes you up with a worship song, your sleep number, and exactly what you need to say in the first meeting, right? Content of your calendar, calendars, man, so you don't drop the ball. It's a source of identity, isn't it, your calendar? You got those people you work with, maybe you're this person, you're like, if you saw my calendar, you wouldn't believe it. Okay. But for some of us, that's like, it's so full. It's like, well, that's my identity. It's like, I'm so busy. For some of us, it's a source of frustration. For some of us, I don't want you to see my calendar because I'm just too busy and I'm embarrassed by it. Some of it's a source of control. That calendar drives my life. And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes it's a source of control. Ultimately though, and this is what we're gonna talk about today, that calendar is a source of priorities, isn't it? One writer says, what is embedded in people's calendar tells the story of what matters most. What is embedded in people's calendar tells the story of what matters most. I should have put the 16th birthday party on my calendar. We were etching things in stone back then, I know, but The content of your calendar tells me what matters most. Can't ignore this. We're going to see that in the book of Esther at the end and consider together this morning how Esther invites us to remember what matters most. Think about that statement. Remember what matters most. Esther 9, it's a lot of verses. The king's command, the law, went into effect on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, on the day when the Jews' enemies had hoped to overpower them. Just the opposite happened. The Jews overpowered those who hated them. In each of King Ahasuerus' provinces, the Jews assembled in their cities to attack those who intended to harm them. Not a single person could withstand them. Fear of them fell on every nationality. All the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, the royal civil administrators aided the Jews because they feared Mordecai. If you've been here, this is all making sense. For Mordecai exercised great power in the palace and his fame spread throughout the provinces as he became more and more powerful. The Jews put all their enemies to the sword, killing and destroying them. They did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the fortress of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, including Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adalia, Aradatha, Parmashta, Arishai, Aridai, and Vazatha. They killed these 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. However, they did not seize any plunder. Underline that. On that day, the number of people killed in the fortress of Susa was reported to the king. The king said to Queen Esther, in the fortress of Susa, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, including Haman's 10 sons. What have they done in the rest of the royal provinces? Whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you seek will also be done. Esther answered, if it pleases the king, may the Jews who are in Susa also have tomorrow to carry out today's law. And may the bodies of Haman's 10 sons be hung on the gallows. Whew. The king gave the orders for this to be done. So a law was announced in Susa and they hung the bodies of Haman's 10 sons. The Jews in Susa assembled again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not seize any plunder. Rest of the Jews in the royal provinces assembled, defended themselves, gained relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of those who hated them. Read this before, but they did not seize any plunder. They fought on the 13th day of the month of Adar and rested on the 14th, and it became a day of feasting and rejoicing. But the Jews in Susa had assembled on the 13th and the 14th days of the month. They rested on the 15th day of the month, and it became a day of feasting and rejoicing. This explains why the royal Jews who lived in villages observed the 14th day of the month of Adar as a time of rejoicing and feasting. Feasting and rejoicing, rejoicing and feasting. It's a holiday, man. When they sent gifts to one another, Mordecai recorded these events and sent letters to all the Jews in all of King Ahasuerus' provinces, both near and far. He ordered them to celebrate the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar every year. It's a feast that gets codified. Because during those days, the Jews, they gained relief from their enemies. That was a month when their sorrow was turned into rejoicing and their mourning into a holiday. They were to be days of feasting, rejoicing, and of sending gifts to one another and to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the practice they had begun as Mordecai had written them to do, For Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them. He cast the pur, that is the lot, to crush and destroy them. But when the matter was brought before the king, he commanded by letter that the evil plan Haman had devised against the Jews return on his own head. The exact opposite happened. And that he should be hanged with his sons on the gallows. For this reason, these days are called Purim, for the word pur, because of all the instructions in this letter, as well as what they had witnessed and what had happened to them. The Jews bound themselves, their descendants and all who joined with them, to a commitment that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days each and every year according to the written instructions and according to the time appointed. These days are remembered and celebrated by every generation, family, province, city, so the days of Purim will not lose their significance in Jewish life and their memory will not fade from their descendants. Queen Esther, daughter of Ahabahel, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote this second letter with full authority to confirm the letter about Purim. He sent letters with assurances of peace and security to all the Jews who were in the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in order to confirm these days of Purim at their proper time, just Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had established them. And just as they had committed themselves and their descendants to the practices of fasting and lamentation. So Esther's command confirmed these customs of Purim, which were then written in the record. King Ahasuerus, chapter 10, imposed a tax throughout the land, even to the farthest shores. All of his powerful and magnificent accomplishments, and the detailed account of Mordecai's great rank with which the king had honored him, have they not been written in the book of the historical events of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus. He was famous among the Jews and highly esteemed by many of his relatives. He continued to pursue prosperity for his people and to speak for the well-being of all his descendants, the word of God. Remember what matters most. I think there's some housekeeping here first. How is this not going from just one genocidal incident to another? You ask yourself that? Someone who doesn't like the God of the Old Testament? Well, okay. If you notice the reversal of the language here, writers tell us, it mirrors what Haman's original decree was. He was going to destroy, now God's people destroy. And in 8:11 last week was a little uncomfortable as we saw women and children were allowed to be killed, non-combatants. Fact of the matter is, 8:11 doesn't necessarily authorize that the Jews could go hunting for women and children. So understand that. The Hebrew way for God's people permits, several translations reflect this, that the sense of the Jews could destroy the armed forces, combatants that attack them and their families. The decree also authorized them to stand on the defensive. And the narrator never records the killing of women and children in what I just read. Another writer puts it this way, without the exertion of effective power, justice cannot be exercised. The innocent and the vulnerable cannot be defended, and the world belongs to powerful aggressors. While contemporary readers of the Book of Esther, that's us, live in peaceful modern societies, we can have great difficulty with the descriptions of the judgment of the enemies of the Jews delivered here. But it's important to recognize that genocidal enemies cannot be effectively defeated with a mere slap on the wrist. Doesn't answer all the questions, but I think it's helpful in understanding the context of the reversal of what happened in this text. The Feast of Purim was established. One theme in the book of Esther is feast. This is the last feast that we see in the book. There were six of them, six feasts. And this is an ironic reversal. Some would see even in the Old Testament writings of Numbers chapter 30, it's an annulment of, a nullification of the very thing that Haman wanted to do, but Haman's decree couldn't be broken. So it's God who reverses what happens. Notice what the text said in verse 1. The king's command and the law went into effect on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, on the day when the Jews' enemies had hoped to overpower them, but just the opposite happened. The Jews overpowered those who hated them. It's interesting that reverse is in the passive verb. The reverse occurred. It was contrary to expectations. Now the tables were turned. One writer says, it's not that the Jews reversed the situation, simply that the situation was reversed. We see the hand of God. Lord of the Rings fans, everything sad comes untrue. That's what happens. That's my extent of Lord of the Rings knowledge, by the way. So, remember what matters most. When exactly the opposite of what we thought was going to happen, the evil that was going to descend on us, the exact opposite happens. So, you know, I love what the Bible asks in 2 Peter. As people of God, what kind of people should we be? What kind of people should we be indeed based on what's happened in the book of Esther? Here's some things for you to think about as we take this book with us. We are delivered people. We are delivered people. I thought of it this way. Think about this in your life and think about this throughout the book of Esther. God is at once moving sovereignly, mysteriously, and predictably in us, our circumstances and other people. Think about that this week. Well, at once, at the same time, God is moving sovereignly. He's in complete control, mysteriously in ways we do not understand and may not understand this side of eternity. And also, very predictably, things happen to you. You lost a job. You got a job. 100 ways that you're like, I saw that coming. I got a raise. I deserved it. I worked hard. And yet, mysteriously and sovereignly, God is working in those predictable circumstances. It's woven together. It's all in the soup, man. We're delivered people. The text never says that the Israelites reversed their circumstances. It says their circumstances were reversed. You know why? Because we're free and God's free, but God's more free than we are because he's sovereign. So in your life and in my life, if you know and follow Jesus, remember this. In the circumstances of the world, God is, even if you don't know Jesus, this is true. God is working sovereignly and mysteriously and very predictably sometimes, all at once, ultimately to deliver his people. Think about all the things we've seen like this in Esther. I wrote these down. There was a refusal. There was a preference. There was a promotion. There was a conversation. There was a forgotten record. There was a sleepless night. There was a political decision, running out of fingers. There was a man's pride. There was a servant's observation. There was a legal decree. There was a change of heart. All those things are predictable in the book. As we read the story together over the course of these last 9 weeks, all these things are predictable, but all these things have had mystery to them. And ultimately, when you step back from them, you say, God is the one who did it. It's the same in our lives, friend. We're delivered people. God is at work to deliver us. It's easy to forget that we're delivered people. Haman's actions suggest that, this was back in chapter 3, they suggested that chance and fate were at the helm of the universe rather than the creator God who providentially ruled over them. Haman's plan was set in motion the day before Passover, which was the day of deliverance. And here we see that, we see the culmination of that, exactly what we said would happen in chapter 3. We knew the end of the story. But for Esther and the people of God and Mordecai, they're living this in real time to see the sovereign, mysterious, and in some ways predictable deliverance of God. We are delivered people. I love 2 Corinthians 1:8. We don't want you to be, this is Paul, we don't want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, of our affliction that took place in Asia. We were completely overwhelmed beyond our strength so that we even despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death so that we would not trust in ourselves, but we would trust in God who raises the dead. He has delivered us from such a terrible death and he will deliver us. We have put our hope in him that he will deliver us again while you join us in helping by your prayers. Then many will give thanks on our behalf for the gift that came to us through the prayers of many. Romans 7:24, Paul writes, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? The answer is Jesus Christ. Friends, ultimately, we are delivered people. What kind of people should we be? Do you rejoice in your deliverance? Whatever that may look like in your life, that God is working sovereignly, mysteriously, predictably in your life. Do we take those things into account? We're different. We are different people. Do you ever run into a Keystone person at the grocery store? Do you ever run into them when you don't want to run into them? You're like, I just finished working out. Look at me. My hair's a wreck. I mean, I don't have to worry about that, but I kind of want to see anybody. I'm ducking down this aisle. I hope they didn't see me. But isn't it cool when you see somebody and you're like, I want to see them? And maybe there's like actually three of you there, like in the produce department. Imagine what a person on the outside thinks looking in on that. Like, how do you all know each other? Well, we're different people. We're brothers and sisters in Christ. We all go to the same church, and sometimes we run into each other in the grocery store and we say, how's it going? People who know and follow Jesus, remember something that's most important is this. We We're delivered people, so that makes us different people. There's a bond we share in the deliverance of Jesus Christ that is intangible. We're different people. What makes us different? Well, here's three things I want you to think about. And this is under the word celebration. Did you read how much in this text it talked about rejoicing and feasting? Well, we're different people. And if we're different people, we celebrate. What we celebrate indicates what we worship. That's the first thing I want to say. Here's a Christian friend, here's a litmus test for us. What we celebrate indicates what we worship. For Haman, it was a prideful, self-centered, and destructive joy. That's what Haman had. In chapter 5:9, when Esther was, don't mess with Esther. She was building her case, and all Haman cared about selfishly is like, well, I got invited to the party. In 5:9, it says Haman left full of joy and good spirits. And when Haman's wife and friends and family gave him the advice to build the gallows, they said, listen, do what satisfies you the most, what makes you the happiest. And then it says this in 5:14, then go and enjoy yourself. Haman's joy was a prideful, self-centered, destructive joy. The joy of the people here rejoicing and feasting and celebrating and resting and having a holiday, it was a humble, communal, and delivered joy by the people of God. What we celebrate indicates what we worship. We're different people. So what we should celebrate should be different. This is important, friends. Show me your calendar. I'll show you what you celebrate. What brings us joy? I wonder, how are you feeding the wrong joy in your life? We are different people, which means what we celebrate indicates what we worship. We're different people because for us, joy, here's another thing in the text, joy is a serious obligation. Do you remember what's at stake in this turn of events in chapter 9? In chapter 3:9, this is what Haman suggested. If the king approves, let an order be drawn up authorizing the destruction of the Jews, and I will pay 375 tons of silver to the officials for deposit in the royal treasury. Listen, that's the line of Jesus Christ himself. What's at stake here is the end of our salvation. So Mordecai says, listen, joy is a serious obligation. It's as serious as this effort, which would cause a break in the line of the Messiah. That's a serious thing. And so Mordecai says, the joy we should share in the fact that that didn't happen, that it was reversed, there should be some partying going on in our lives. And soon it codifies this entire celebration of Purim. One writer says, Haman the Agagite, the one who came from a historical enemy of the Jews who had not been finished off when they should have been by Saul. You remember the story? What Haman was trying to do was enormously serious. And so the obligation that goes with the rescue from it is equally serious. Is joy serious in your life? It's a serious obligation. It's a resolve, one writer says, an instruction, a law, this Feast of Purim. That's all about rejoicing. So Mordecai writes the recorded events and sends letters out and says, include this with all the other festivals that are on the Jewish calendar through Moses. This one comes from me. The feast that Moses said, celebrate these back in the Pentateuch, Mordecai says, I got one to add. You know why? We're delivered people, so we're different people. What we celebrate shows what we worship. And joy is an obligation. Joy is a serious obligation. Friends, 5 minutes before I walked in here this morning, I talked with a couple who's going through suffering. I've talked to two this morning like that. Had a conversation, how's it going? Got an update? Look at verse 22, because, and it says this twice in the text, because during those days, the Jews gained what's it say? Relief from their enemies. They gained relief from their enemies. Couple nights this week, it got cool in the evening. Did you notice that? Isn't that awesome in Iowa? You're like, oh, I can sit on my deck. It's no longer the surface of the sun. Man, it's awesome. It's gonna be hot again this week. Deal with it, I know, but. The people of God gain relief from their enemies. When was the last time you gained relief from something? God answered a prayer in your life. God delivered you from a sickness. Some relationship in your life was healed. God answered a prayer. You just, listen, we're delivered people from the curse of sin because of Jesus. I get that. But every day, in big and small ways, the sovereign God works mysteriously and predictably to relieve us, to say, delivered. And maybe it's not how we wanted or hoped or complete, but there are so many people in his church praying for relief, deliverance. We're praying with you. We're praying for you. We're praying with joy, though. Because joy is a serious obligation to know that we stand delivered, relieved, ultimately. And so we work hard praying for one another that God, you would bring relief to brothers and sisters who are suffering. Joy is a serious obligation. Joy changes everything. Look at verses 19 and 22. It affected the people. One writer says it affected the people's emotions and their behavior. New things were said. New songs were sung. New people got presents. Merry Christmas. That's what it's like. But Purim's like Christmas. Mordecai says, listen, go to each other's houses and make your best thing and go feast and have joy. It's a serious obligation, and the way you treat the poor and the downtrodden, all of it should be different because you're delivered. Are you like that, Keystone? Are we like that? What do we celebrate? It shows what we worship. What's on our calendar? Because that's what matters most. Are we people of joy? It's a serious obligation. It changes everything. Psalm 30:11, psalmist says, God, you turned my lament into dancing. You removed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness so I can sing to you and not be silent. I will praise you forever. Psalm 40:23, God brought me up from a desolate pit out of the muddy clay and set my feet on a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. What's that question I ask? How are you feeding the wrong joy? Are you really a different person because of what you celebrate? Show me what you celebrate, I'll show you what you worship. Football is back, baby. Iowa State fans, you ready? You worried? Okay. Iowa, you're ranked. You happy? Yeah, okay, all right. Soccer fans, we mean like the real football. I mean, I read that in an article this week, needlessly provocative, I know, but someone wrote that, like, football's back, the real football. Next weekend, some of you gonna be tailgating, kicking your kids out of the family room. Game's on. Nothing wrong with that. But it helps when we talk about what we celebrate, what makes us different people. You've cultivated a joy for football. One writer says this, there are two ways of trying to disciple someone away from the love of the world. One is to demonstrate that loving the world is useless. The other is to show that they will be happier if they exchange their love of the world for a love of God. To exchange an old affection for a new one. We could call these negative approaches, loving the world is bad, and positive approaches, loving God is better. Which one do you think works? Practically, we all know this. The best way to lose weight is not to focus on the futility and dissatisfaction of eating what you like, but to displace one desire, food, with another, better health, fitness, body shape, stability of mood, or whatever. The best way to get people off their phones is not to lament the evils of screen time, but awaken the desire for doing something else, reading a book, playing sports, creating something, or gasp, talking to people in real life. We don't change because we are convinced that our current habits are pointless or debilitating. We change because we think that doing something else will make us happier than we are now. That's true. The only way to get rid of an old affection is by the power of a new one. Listen, I hope you go crazy in football season. But I'm just asking you, are you different people, Keystone, because of what you celebrate? Because to you, joy in God is a serious obligation and it changes everything. Is it the priority of your life? Are you celebrating the wrong joy? We are different people. We are devoted people. We are delivered people, which makes us different people. We are devoted people. This is the end of the text through 10, the end of 9 through 10. Three things. We are devoted people to practicing the way. That's the title of a book. I stole it. Whatever. Practicing the way. Mordecai's concern. Do you see? Look at the end of 10. He continued to pursue prosperity for who? For his people, and to speak for the well-being of all his descendants. Here was a priority to Mordecai, my people. We're devoted to one another, friends. The reason we want you in a connection group, the reason we put this lovely couple up here on the screen to tell you what connection group means to them is because we care about people. We care about the family of God. We are devoted people to practicing the way, Galatians 6, let us not get tired of doing good, for we will reap at the proper time if we don't give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us work for the good of all people, especially for those who belong to the household of faith. We're devoted people, which means we practice the way. Here's a couple other things. We pursue the well-being of the city. Don't miss this, friend. You want a lesson in what matters most? Be devoted to one another, to the city around us. We at Keystone, we like to say to the community, the campus, and the world. Did you see how chapter 10 started? How about that for a boring ending to a story? So the king imposed a tax. So it all comes back to politics, huh? Well, you know, there's a huge subplot in this book about raising taxes. That one desire in his book was Ahasuerus wanted to raise taxes. And Haman's like, I'll get it done for you. We'll kill all these people. Esther at one point told the king, she's like, hey, you know, If you would enslave my people, you'd make money off us. But just killing us, that's not going to help. I mean, this thing of raising taxes was a theme the whole way through. So in some ways, it fits that the end of the story would be this. King Ahasuerus, he got his tax hike because of Mordecai, probably. Scholars tell us the reason he was able to do this is Mordecai said, listen, all that stuff I told you wouldn't work, it didn't work. Also, When we got our revenge, the people of God, we could have taken the plunder. Did they take the plunder or not? No. Three times in chapter 9, it says they could have. And it says they didn't touch the plunder. Know why? Mordecai understood what that pagan king wanted from him. And so he said, you can trust me, man. One of the biggest problems Ahasuerus had in this book is who can I trust? Nobody. You trust Mordecai, though. He's a man of God. To him, it wasn't just about practicing the way, taking care of God's people. It was pursuing the well-being of the city of Susa, saying, dude, I'll get you your tax hike. One writer says, Mordecai and Esther are people marked by wisdom and loyalty and trustworthiness. They are like Joseph. They use their influence not for personal gain, but for the good of others, bringing order and peace and blessing to the kingdom. Their wisdom is exercised from positions of when they were vulnerable and when they were in authority. They didn't change. Their loyalty proved them trustworthy, standing in contrast to Haman, who was selfish and unfaithful. In this way, Esther ends by showing God's people flourishing through faithful, wise leadership. Mordecai says, hey, we didn't take any plunder. We'll pay your taxes. This fulfills God's promise. One writer says that Abraham's descendants would be a blessing to the nations. Pursue these texts, pursue the well-being of the city. I got that statement right out of the Bible. How about that? Pursue the well-being of the city, Jeremiah says, when the people were in exile. I have deported you to pray to the Lord on its behalf, for when it thrives, you will thrive. We're devoted people. Keystone, we're devoted to each other. We're devoted to this community around us. We have a job to do. We're responsible. We're different people. We're delivered people. Let's take that to the city. Romans 13:6, for this reason you pay taxes, since the authorities are God's servants. Look what these next three words say. Continue to attend to these. Pass it on to the next generation. That's the last thing. Pass it on to the next generation. I heard this in a sermon a couple weeks ago. Rhythms and rituals help us run. Verse 28 says, these days are remembered and celebrated by every generation. How's school going, mom and dad, first week back? Rough? You're like, I've already been late for pickup twice. I'm that parent now. Chaos. As a grandparent, I'm living vicariously through my kids who have two kids starting kindergarten. One of my kids, though, they have one starting kindergarten and one potty training. I pray for them, which is nice that that's all I have to do. But some of you there, right? I know it's tough, but mom and dad, what rhythms and rituals are you building to help you run? This church once a month sets aside the ritual of celebrating Jesus' death, burial and resurrection in communion. We celebrate baptism. We build rituals into this place. But mom and dad, in the chaos of sports and school and family and everything else, what rituals that show who you celebrate and what matters most are you building into your life? Because that makes you run. The rhythms in your family, the rituals you celebrate. Pass it on to the next generation. That's what devoted people do. Come to the end of Esther. Remember what matters most. We're delivered people. The story of Esther reminds us that it looks like everything is lost. God is already at work. Jews were delivered because God providentially turned the tables. Same is true for us. Our greatest deliverance has been accomplished through Christ. We could never accomplish this for ourselves. It was accomplished through his son. So we're different people, delivered people. We have something we're celebrating, and Esther ends with worship. We don't have to keep chasing the empty joys of the world. In Christ, we have a greater joy, a joy that suffering can't steal, death can't destroy. We're devoted people. We don't simply remember the deliverance of God. We live differently because of it. We practice the way of Jesus. We devote ourselves to his people, to doing good, to pursuing the well-being of this city around us, the place that God has put us, and to passing the story of his faithfulness on to the next generation. God, help us to be those people. May we take the message of this beautiful story and the powerful hand of a silent God behind it as you work in our lives that way and mysteriously and predictably. Lord, help us to be those people delivered and different and devoted. If there's one here who doesn't know the great deliverer, Jesus, may that person find Christ. We thank you for him and his work in his name. Amen.